50 years later, I can say that in my career as a leader, I've received just about every kind of perk imaginable. I've received titles, recognition, honorary degrees, authority, nice offices, good parking places, money, preferential treatment, you name it, I've had it. However, none of these things motivates me as a leader. I lead because of what I can do for other people. That's the best motivation to lead others. It took time to get there, but I made the shift from being focused on what I can receive as a leader, the perks, to what I can give as a leader, the price. So let's take a look at the kinds of questions leaders ask themselves based upon where they focus. For example, if I'm a leader who focuses on perks, these are the kind of questions I'm asking. What will I receive? How will this decision affect me? How long will this take me? What will you give me if I stay in the game? You see, if I'm a perks person, those are the questions I'm going to ask. Now, if I'm a person who focuses on the price of leadership, I ask myself a total different set. I ask questions such as, what can I give? How will this decision affect others? How far can we go? And what must I give to stay in the game? You see, the choice to lead because of benefits benefits no one, not even the leader. Focusing on the perks won't take you anywhere worthwhile because deep inner fulfillment never comes from perks. What they offer is ultimately hollow, and they have never helped a leader to reach his or her potential. Leaders who focus on perks end up misusing their leadership, and because they love perks more than people, they are continually tempted to misuse people to receive, maintain, or improve their perks. If you want to reach your potential, become the best leader you can be, and make the greatest impact, then you must shift from perks to price in your leadership. A price is what stands between you and your potential. If you want to be a better leader, you need to pay for it. Your price points. While many of the specifics of the price will be unique to each individual leader, there are some common costs that every leader needs to take into account. I want to discuss three that should be a part of every leader's leadership, from perks to price. Number one, reality. Leaders recognize that everything worthwhile is uphill. Max Dupree, CEO of the furniture giant Herman Miller, said, "The first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. Let me define the reality of your leadership potential. It's uphill all the way. No one ever coasted to success. No successful person has ever experienced accidental achievements. Nothing of genuine value is easy, quick, or downhill. All the precious things in life require that we pay a price. Contrary to the line in the old song, the best things in life are not free. Or as someone told me once during a break in the line of my speeches, if it doesn't suck, it's not worth doing." There's a lot of difference between what we can't do and what we won't do. What we won't do will keep you from being successful a lot more than what we can't do. Poor choices, not lack of talent and ability, are the greatest hindrances to most people's success. If we want to succeed in leadership, we must do what we don't want to do so that we can do what we need to do. We must be willing to pay the price. Early American missionary Adoniram Judson is rumored to have said, "There is no success without sacrifice. If you succeed without sacrifice, it is because someone has suffered before you. And if you sacrifice without success, it is because someone will succeed after." As a leader, how can you prepare yourself to pay the price required to reach your potential? How do you get ready for this long uphill journey? I think you can learn a lesson from Navy Vice Admiral James Stockdale. In his book, Good to Great, Jim Collins writes about Stockdale and what Collins calls the Stockdale paradox. Stockdale was a pilot who spent 8 years imprisoned in North Vietnam's notorious Hanoi Hilton after he was shot down during the Vietnam War. He was frequently tortured and abused. When Collins interviewed Stockdale, the former admiral said his imprisonment was the defining event of my life, explaining, "I never lost faith in the end of the story. I never doubted not only that I would get out, but that I would also prevail." Collins was intrigued by this man whose body decades later still showed signs of being broken, but the spirit, which was as indomitable as ever. "Who didn't make it out?" Collins asked a little hesitantly. "Oh, that's easy," he said. "The optimist." When a confused Collins asked him to explain, Stockdale said, "Oh, they were the ones who said, 'We're going to be out by Christmas.' And Christmas would come, and Christmas would go. And then they'd say, 'Well, we're going to be out by Easter.' And Easter would come, and Easter would go. And then Thanksgiving, and then it would be Christmas again. And they died of a broken heart." What Stockdale said next gave Collins the idea for the Stockdale paradox. This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they may be. Here's how Collins states the Stockdale paradox. Retain faith that you will prevail in the end, regardless of the difficulties, and at the same time, confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. These twin expectations of faith and fact help us to believe we can prevail in the end, but remind us that the process will not be easy. I express these twin expectations to myself using different words. As I prepare to lead, I think of hope and hard. These words help me prepare to handle the very difficult expectations needed for leadership. Hope empowers me to believe that I can make the climb. It fuels me with energy to continue when I get tired, and it enables me to speak hope into the lives of the people who are journeying with me. I cannot give hope to others if I do not possess it myself. It must come from a place of authenticity, because you can't fake hope. As you encourage yourself, your people feel that encouragement too. As you encourage them, you also become encouraged. It creates a positive cycle that keeps everyone moving forward. While I love the encouragement of hope, I also value the level-setting word hard. It balances my expectations and prevents me from being naively optimistic. I remind myself that the leadership journey is often difficult. Much of success lies in possessing right expectations. I confess that during the early years of my leadership, I possessed an excess of hope, but had very little knowledge or expectations of how hard leading would be. As a result, I set myself and those that I led up for disappointment. We expected the best, and that's the only thing we prepared ourselves for, and when the things got hard and didn't go perfectly, we weren't ready for it. When you don't prepare for the worst wins. Nowhere was my experience more challenging than at Skyline Church in Lemon Grove, California. I began my leadership there in 1981. The church's attendance had plateaued for quite some time, but soon started growing again, and it quickly became clear that we would need to relocate. Our current facilities were dated, and we were using every inch of space that we had. There was no room for expansion, and the neighborhood where the church was located was becoming less safe. I had initiated the construction of a new building at both of my previous churches that I had led, so I didn't go into this process blindly. I knew it would not be easy, and I knew that relocating the whole church to a new campus would be more difficult than the other projects that I had overseen. I began working with my board and processing them through the decision to relocate. We also started doing our due diligence. It took some time, but we made the decision, planned the process in October of 1987. We asked the congregation to vote on our decision to buy 80 acres of land in nearby El Cajon. When we started, We expect that the whole process from land purchase to relocation to take about 4 years and cost $25 million. To say that we underestimated it would be a huge understatement. After we bought the land for $1.8 million and the survey revealed that it was actually 110 acres, plus we gained access to additional acreage, which totaled up to 130 acres, we thought things were going our way. But then the trouble started. The land was declared a protected habitat for two species of birds, severely restricting where and when construction could be done. Environmental officials also discovered coastal sage on the land and declared that we could not build anywhere that it grew. The local water district required the church to purchase additional water rights. The local commission opposed the construction plan and forced the church to change the location of the first building and redraw its plans. The state insisted that the church pay for improvements on the highway that bordered the property. The county refused to issue building permits. Huge amounts of granite were discovered on the property, requiring major demolition. Building requirements for earthquakes changed, raising the construction costs significantly, and on and on and on it went. I fought these battles from 1987 until 1995, when I stepped down from leadership of the church. My successor, Jim Garlow, continued to fight them until the church finally entered their new building in April of 2000. What I thought would take 4 years and $25 million took 13 years and more than $36 million. And Jim continued to build and battle for another decade after that. During that season, I continually had to balance hope and hard while communicating to the congregation. They needed to be encouraged enough to hold on to the vision, passionate enough to overcome all the obstacles we were facing, and inspired enough to stay engaged in the process and continue supporting it emotionally and financially. But they also needed to be apprised of the obstacles and the setbacks. If they understood how difficult the process was, they would be more understanding. But I didn't want them to become discouraged. That season was one of the most challenging of my life as a leader, and it taught me lessons about communicating expectations up front. Management consultant and business visionary Peter Drucker said, "A time of turbulence is a dangerous time, but its greatest danger is the temptation to deny reality." As leaders, we can't deny reality, nor should we try to sugarcoat it when communicating with our people. We need to bring reality into the conversation as soon as possible. In other words, we should strive to be upfront with the hard part of any journey that we plan to take others on. I used to wait for a good time to share hard realities with others, and then I realized that there's never a good time to share hard news, and the longer that I waited, the harder it was to talk about it. Since then, I've made it a regular practice to look for and mention any downside to a process I'm trying to communicate. I want people to know there is a price to pay for progress. No matter what you want to do in life, you have to face reality, and you have to be willing to pay the price required to go uphill. The sooner you start climbing and the more you're willing to pay, the higher you can go. Number two, example. Leaders acknowledge they must climb the hill first. All people with leadership ability have one perspective in common, before and more. They see things before others do, and they see more than other people do. However, what sets great leaders apart from all other leaders is this. They act before others, and they do more than others. Great leaders face their uncertainty and doubt, and they move through it to pave the way for others. And because they are willing to pay the price first, and often pay more than others do, they can say with moral authority, "Follow me." This doesn't mean great leaders don't have all the same human failings as everyone else. I suspect that even Moses, as he started to walk across the bed of the Red Sea, asked himself, "Why must I always go first?" When times are tough and challenges are difficult, being first isn't a perk. It's a cost that has to be paid. In the uphill climb to achieving something worthwhile, leaders have to pay that price by climbing first and leading the way. There is no elevator to the top. Someone has to find the path and set the example. A person's title or position doesn't help here. The climb isn't enhanced by college degrees or by material possessions. No one is inspired by any of those things. It's the actions leaders take that inspire others to follow and to rally to the vision. Great leaders take action. They move out front, staying ahead, but within sight of their people, and they say, "Follow me." The example of a good leader continually inspires people. Follow me leaders know it's their responsibility to set the example. Over the years, I've observed that they share three common before and more characteristics. First, follow me leaders believe in themselves before and more than others do. I've observed a lot of successful people whom others have not believed in, but I've yet to meet a successful person who did not believe in him or herself. Self-belief comes first. As leaders, we cannot give to others what we do not possess ourselves. Speaker and author Bob Berg told a great story that sheds light on the power of belief. A defense attorney was arguing a case for his client who was charged with murder. Despite the fact that the victim's body was never discovered, the circumstantial evidence was overwhelming, and everyone in the courtroom, including the jurors, knew that the defendant was guilty. The clever lawyer decided to go for broke. As he addressed the jury in his closing argument, he pointed toward the courtroom door and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, in exactly 60 seconds, the so-called corpse, the man you believe is dead, is going to come walking into this courtroom right through those very doors. We can begin counting now." Immediately, the eyes of all the jurors went to the door. The time ticked by. 1 second, 2, 3, 10 seconds, 20, 45, 55 seconds, 57, 58, 59 seconds, and finally, 1 minute. At exactly the 1 minute mark, wouldn't you know it, but who should come striding in through those doors? Absolutely no one. Certainly not the victim. The lawyer now looked at the jury, and again he spoke in a conciliatory, reasoning, almost patronizing tone. "Now, ladies and gentlemen, I must apologize. I told you something that clearly did not come true. However, you will have to admit that the mere fact that each and every one of you looked toward those doors as you did showed me, and it showed you and showed everyone in the courtroom, that you had some doubt. And as the judge will instruct you, if there's any doubt in your minds, any doubt at all, you must return a verdict of not guilty and set my client free." The jury went into the jury room to deliberate and came back in just 5 minutes later to render their verdict. The foreman stood up, faced the defendant, and when asked by the judge what the verdict was, said that they declared the defendant guilty. The defense attorney was enraged. "How could you?" he said. "I saw you all watching those doors." The foreman glanced at the defense attorney and replied, "Yes, sir, we did. But we were also watching you and your client. And you did not watch the door. Your client did not watch the door. And that's because neither of you believed for even a moment that anyone was actually going to be walking in through there." The moral of the story? Don't expect anyone to believe in something that you don't believe in yourself. Self-belief is more than saying positive words to myself or receiving them from others. As radio broadcaster Paul Harvey said, "If you don't live it, you don't believe it. Words of affirmation without the work of accomplishment are hollow. Even if others believe in you, their borrowed belief must be activated by success and become self-belief if it is to be sustained. Borrowed belief without results soon loses its power. A leader's self-belief must be authentic, and it must be backed up with successful action. Follow me leaders set expectations for themselves before and more than others do. I mentioned in Chapter 2 that I teach a lesson called JMT DNA to my new John Maxwell team coaches every time we meet. One of the values I personally embrace, that I also want them to embrace, is exceeding expectations. I want my coaches to expect more of themselves than others do. As speaker and author Brian Tracy said, your success in your career will be in direct proportion to what you do after you've done what you are expected to do. Leaders are in trouble when they need someone else to set the level of expectations. If that continues, they will cease to lead others. Sadly, there are a lot of people who go in the opposite direction trying to do as little as they can to stay afloat in their careers. It's like they're treading water in the pool during an Olympic swimming race. They're like these employees described in what are said to be actual employee evaluations. Since my last report, this employee has reached rock bottom and started to dig. Wow. Here's another one. Works well under constant supervision and when cornered like a rat. Here's one. He would be out of his depth in a parking lot puddle. Or this young lady has delusions of adequacy. He sets low personal standards and consistently fails to achieve them. Wow. Talk about low expectations. This employee should go far, and the sooner he starts, the better. Or he brings a lot of joy whenever he leaves the room. Or if you see two people talking and one looks bored, he's the other one. Gates are down, lights are flashing, but the train isn't coming. If you give him a penny for his thoughts, you'd get change. Some drink from the fountain of knowledge. He only gargled. Well, those are funny kind of references to people who have low expectations and probably fulfill them. But I just want you to know this. I don't know whether these lines come from a real-life evaluations that have been claimed, but you get the idea. You can't set a low standard of performance for yourself and expect to lead other people effectively. If you want to be a good leader, you must have high expectations for yourself. I like the advice given by Diane Snedeker, Executive Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer of the First Republic Bank, who said, set your standards high and keep them high. If you are interested in success, it's easy to set your standards in terms of other people's accomplishments and then let other people measure you by those standards. But the standards you set for yourself are always the more important. They should be higher than the standards anyone else would set for you, because in the end, you have to live with yourself and judge yourself and feel good about yourself. And the best way to do that is to live up to your highest potential. So set your standards high and keep them high, even if you think no one is looking. Somebody out there will always notice, even if it's just you. If you're a leader, you must set the standards high for yourself before anyone else does. Follow me leaders make commitments to themselves before and more than themselves. To be successful, leaders must continually make commitments. Commitment is the key. But the first and most important commitment that any leader makes to himself or to herself is a commitment to integrity, responsibility, and selflessness. Good leaders promise themselves they will pay the price and follow through regardless of the circumstances. One of the leaders I most admire is Abraham Lincoln. Before Lincoln became president, few people expected him to be one of the nation's greatest leaders. In fact, the New York Times said he was unqualified for the presidency of the United States. But Lincoln was committed to helping the nation. He later revealed his mindset of commitment. I never have done an official act with a view to promote my own personal agenda, and I don't like to begin now. If you're a leader, or you desire to become one, you must always be ready, willing, and committed to climbing the hill first. Climb first, setting the example, and then call out, "Follow me." And if you're willing to do that, there's still one more quality you must display as you pay the price of leadership. Number 3, consistency. Leaders understand that they never get to stop climbing. I have another confession to make. Early in my leadership, I thought that if I led well for a season, I could earn the right to take shortcuts and quit making sacrifices. I thought I could pay the price for a little while, be done paying it, and then enjoy the good life, the perks that come with having paid a price. That created a blind spot in my leadership and led to what I call destination disease. I thought that I could arrive at a time, a place, a situation that would give me the greatest of all perks, recognition, without responsibility. There is no such place unless you're going to get out of the game. But I don't want out of the game. I'm more than 70 years old, and I still like the game. What I've discovered is that I had to give up to go up, and I have to give up even more if I want to stay up. There's a reason that sports teams seldom have back-to-back championships. The perks that come with the first championship often become a hindrance to achieving the next one. When a team earns the first championship, they don't get the next one free. Dwight David Eisenhower, whose leadership experience included serving as both a general and a president of the United States, said, "There is no victory at bargain basement prices. If you desire to go to higher levels of leadership, you need to keep paying the price. The price will be higher than you think. It will have to be paid continually and consistently." Jim Collins said, "The signature of mediocrity is chronic inconsistency. A corollary to that would be that the signature of excellence is relentless consistency. But excellence doesn't show up quickly. You have to be able to work at it and sustain it." It's been my privilege to play a few rounds of golf with several PGA players. One of them explained to me the reason most tournaments consist of several rounds. He said, "Almost any good professional golfer can shoot one good round. Having to shoot a second good round typically knocks out half the competitors. A third round eliminates another half of the remaining players," and he said, "by the fourth round, it's the real test of consistency for a golfer. Anyone who can sustain that consistency rises above the rest and deserves to be rewarded." Bill Bradley was a great basketball player who later became a U.S. Senator. In his memoir, he recounted his basketball mentor, Ed McCauley, telling him, "If you're not practicing, remember, someone somewhere is practicing. And given roughly equal ability, if you two ever meet, he will win." Bradley took that advice and determined that in his basketball career, there would be no off-season. That's how leaders need to see it, too. There is no off-season for leadership. As long as you're in the game, you need to keep working and keep climbing. You'll be glad to know that your efforts will be rewarded. And here are some of the ways consistency will help you as a leader. Consistency provides security for others. Anthropologist Margaret Mead observed, "What people say and what they do and what they say they do are entirely different things. If you're a consistent leader, that should not be true of you. Your words, intentions, and actions should all line up. People know where you stand and how you deliver. Others can depend upon you, which is perhaps the highest compliment you can receive as a leader. Consistency establishes your reputation. Just about everyone can be good every once in a while. It's more difficult to be good every time. Consistency lifts people above the crowd and sets them apart. It can make you someone that others notice. And that's important in leadership because the people you lead are always watching you. When you deliver time after time, you develop a reputation for coming through when needed. Not only does that help you to influence people, it also sets the tone for your team. People do what people continually see. The more consistent you are, the more consistent they will want to be. Consistency keeps you in the leadership game. When you're consistent, it means never having to restart or get back into the swing of things. You're already swinging. Your constant progress keeps morale high, keeps enthusiasm brimming, and increases your investment in whatever goal you're pursuing. Author and speaker Michael Angier said, "If you develop the habits of success, you'll make success a habit. If you're consistently on top of your game, you never have to gear up and get back into the game." Consistency compounds. What did genius Albert Einstein call the greatest mathematical discovery of all time? Not calculus, not even the theory of relativity. Compound interest. Wealth that grows based on continual reinvestment. And what's the secret to compound interest? Consistency. It never stops growing. One of my favorite examples of the compounding power of consistency occurred in the world of professional baseball in the 1980s and 90s with Cal Ripken Jr. He's in the Hall of Fame, but he isn't there because he was the best hitter, best fielder, best base stealer. He's there because of consistency. Ripken played in 2,632 consecutive games, the Major League Baseball record by a long shot. Only one other player passed the 2,000 mark, and that was Lou Gehrig, with 2,160 consecutive games. For more than 40 years, baseball fans believed that Gehrig's record would never be broken. The rarity of that kind of consistency becomes clear when you recognize that only five other players in Major League history have ever played in more than 1,000 consecutive games. Maybe that's why the game in which Ripken passed Gehrig's record was voted the most memorable in Major League Baseball history, ahead of Gehrig's farewell speech in 1939, ahead of Hank Aaron's home run record, and even ahead of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in 1947. Ripken was quick to say that his success didn't come from being more talented than everyone else. When asked if he was a superstar, he responded, "Superstar? Oh, no. I don't think I stack up with the great talents in the league. I have talent, no doubt. My advantage is that I know the game well. The reason is that I grew up in it, and I had a good teacher in my father. And I'm sure that whatever I am as a man and as a ball player comes from the way that I was raised." Years later, Ripken said of his record, "The streak was really born out of a very simple and honest approach. Dad always taught me to show up at the ballpark each and every day ready to play. And if the manager believes you are one of the nine guys who can help the team win that day, he knows he can count on you, and he'll put you in the lineup." That's simply how the streak started and how it grew over the years. In other words, he showed up, worked hard, played hurt, and gave his very best every day for 16 years straight. He was the definition of consistency. Recently, I was backstage before a speaking engagement, waiting to be introduced to the audience. The host described me as an amazing leader. I mention this only because I know I'm not amazing. Rather, I'm experienced as a leader, and I've stayed consistent. I'm just experiencing the compounding effect of having paid the price to improve as a leader for a really long time. So at this point in my career, I look better than I actually am. If you want to have an amazing impact as a leader, you need to make the shift from perks to price and do many unamazing things as you make the difficult uphill climb of leadership and set the example for your team. The reality is that practicing is not amazing. Studying is not amazing. Showing up is not amazing. Working hard, it's not amazing. Asking questions is not amazing. Changing is not amazing. Trying is not even amazing. Failing, not amazing. Trying again is not amazing. But every one of these things is necessary. They are all the price you must pay every day to reach your potential. And if you pay that price and do it consistently, the final result, my friend, can be amazing. In this last chapter, shifting from perks to price, I talked about the fact that it's a fact everything worthwhile is uphill. Several years ago, on a 60 Minutes program, a mountain climber was being interviewed, and he had just finished climbing Mount Everest, and it was an extremely difficult climb. In fact, a couple of members of the climb did not make it to the top, and they died. So in this interview, the man on 60 Minutes asked this mountain climber why he took these risks and why he worked so hard and why he kept such a high level of commitment to just climb up to a mountain. He just basically looked at him and said, why do you pay this kind of a price to climb a mountain? And the mountain climber just simply looked at the interviewer and he just said to him in such a simple, beautiful way, it's obvious to me that you've never been to the top of the mountain. Now, I don't think he was trying to be a smart aleck. I think he was basically overwhelmed about anybody that would ask him about the price of mountain climbing, because he also understood that the view at the top was worth the price you paid on the way up. You see, the price that we pay as a leader is the climbing, and it's uphill all the way. You don't get to climb downhill, except maybe through a couple passes on the way uphill. It's all uphill. It's not like I climbed downhill to success. I had to climb uphill to success. So the climbing is the price that you pay. The perk? Wow. That's showing people the view, a view that they only would get if they climbed the mountain. And what I would say to each one of you today as leaders is very simple. The price always comes first. Nobody ever gets a peak from the top without doing the climb first. You pay the price, then you get the perk, the view. And I would just say to all of us that sometimes we forget that we need to pay now and then play later. We want to play today, and hopefully somehow we think we will be able to maybe play tomorrow. My father taught me this beautiful principle when I was a child growing up. He basically said to me, John, you either pay now and you play later, or you play now and you pay later. Well, as a kid, I kind of wanted to play now and maybe pay at a later time, but my father taught me that it was quite simple, that if you play now, when you finally have to pay, the price is compounded and is greater than the payment would have been on the front end. And so when we think of going and making this leadership from perks to price, just remember this. Pay the price today. It's as cheap as it's ever going to get. And the perks will come, but the price must come first. Wow. That may be a tough leadership, but it is a rewarding one for anyone who has ever been at the top. The feeling of accomplishment and fulfillment when you take people to the top and they say, I was with you. I was doing a speech in Seattle with a mountain climber. This was amazing. And I asked him, because he had climbed all the famous mountains of the world, and I asked him during lunch, what was his greatest accomplishment? And here's what he told me. He said, my greatest accomplishment is that I've taken more people to the top of the mountain than any other mountain climber in the world. And I thought to myself, this man's a leader. He's a mountain climber, but he's a leader. His greatest accomplishment wasn't getting to the top himself, but helping other people get to the top. And guess what? It's harder that way. It's slower that way. It takes longer that way. It's much more difficult. But when you take people to the top, that's the perk, the joy of knowing you've done for others what they couldn't do for themselves. And that's what paying the price is all about. Okay, my friend, I'm ready to go to chapter 5. And talk to you about the shift from pleasing people to challenging people. Let's get going. Chapter 5, Pleasing People to Challenging People, The Relational Shift. You cannot lead people if you need people. Pleasing people is not the same as leading people. That was one of the first most important lessons I had to learn about leadership. It defined a new reality for me, and it was very difficult for me to learn. Early in my life, I realized that most people liked me. My relational connections with others were strong. My teachers liked me. Kids wanted to hang out with me and be around me in the classroom and on the playground. Intuitively, I knew what mattered to people was my ability to please them, so naturally I worked hard at developing my people skills. It felt like my leadership mojo was making everyone happy, and doing it made me happy. Now, during those early years, I might have defined leadership as make people happy and they will follow you. I was continually asking myself one question, is everybody happy? But if you're a leader, the answer is no. You can never make everyone happy, and wanting to do so is a setup for disappointment or failure. Who needs a wake-up call? I started my professional leadership career at the age of 22, and as already mentioned, I was the leader of a small congregation in Indiana. For the first 6 months, I felt that everyone was happy. The people liked me. I liked them. It was kumbaya time. Then one day I created trouble in paradise. There was an ugly painting in the small lobby of the church, and I thought about how it needed to go, but it hadn't been a priority. I didn't say anything about it to anyone, but I got around to removing it. I considered it a small improvement that I was glad to make. The reaction was immediate and negative. You have thought that I called somebody's baby ugly. Right away, I learned that two members of the congregation had given that painting as a gift to the church and had placed it in a prominent spot themselves, and when they learned that I had removed it, to say they were not happy is a gross understatement. Now, I quickly apologized. I put the painting back. Whew! That was close. I had dodged the bullet and gone from a bad leader to a good leader because everyone was happy again. But a few weeks later, I faced another problem. The youth of our church were playing in a basketball game, and I promised to attend. But then a member of the church called me with an emergency situation, and I missed the game. The coach of our team and a few of the parents were not happy about it. Uh-oh, I needed to do something, so I explained the situation, and whew, the parents got happy again, but the coach wasn't happy. I went on working to please him. I visited him twice to smooth things over. I attended the next two games, even though I hadn't promised to, and finally, I won him back over to the happy side. Hey, I had succeeded again, but boy, was this happy stuff beginning to wear me out. How could I possibly keep up with making everybody happy? Well, for 2 years I did everything I could to try to make everyone I led happy. I sincerely believed that if my leadership was good, everybody would like me and everything I did. And if anyone didn't like me or something I did, then it must mean that there was something wrong with my leadership and I needed to fix it. That thinking motivated every action I took and every decision I made. What a mistake. No leader can please everyone all the time. Even history's greatest leaders had their opponents, but back then I hadn't yet realized that. When the reality struck me that everyone wasn't happy all the time, I hit an emotional wall. I believed that I was a bad leader, and I even wondered if I should resign from my position and try to lead somewhere else. But then I got wise counsel from leaders with more experience. They helped me to understand that it's impossible to please everyone. Then they taught me an even more important insight about myself. I was doing things backward. My goal was to get people to like me enough so that I could gain the confidence to ask them for commitment. If they declined, I simply worked harder to try to get them to like me more, thinking that that would solve a problem. And worse still, I gave the most time and energy to the unhappiest and least committed people, even though they were not contributing to the vision or helping to move the organization forward. In other words, I was letting the tail wag the dog. I finally realized that I wasn't leading people. I was trying to make them and myself feel good. I wasn't moving the organization forward. I was in the friendship business, not the leadership business. I wasn't taking people anywhere or helping them do better or get better. I was trying to live in Happyville. To get the best out of people, leaders must ask for the best from people. I wasn't doing that at all. Once I realized this, I wish I could say that I shifted from pleasing people to challenging people quickly and easily, but I can't. The process of change for me was very slow. My desire to be liked by others was deeply rooted within me, to the point where my best days in leadership were the ones where people affirmed me, and I craved that affirmation every day. But I recognized that affirmation doesn't equal leadership accomplishment, so I vowed to change, step by step. I talked myself out of the idealistic thoughts and feelings that I had as a young leader and coached myself to try to become the leader that the people really needed, not just the one that they wanted. I made the leader shift from pleasing people to challenging people. How to shift from pleaser to leader? I don't know whether you have the people-pleasing tendencies that I once had, and if so, you need to make the same difficult leader shift that I did, because you can never really lead your organization, serve your people, or reach your leadership potential if you're always trying to make them happy. You have to put doing what's right for your people and your organization ahead of what feels right for you. To make that shift, you need to do these 7 things. Number 1, change your expectations toward leadership. The heart of my people-pleasing problem was a desire to do what made me feel good. That included an unwillingness to deal with difficult issues. To fix this, I had to change the way I thought about leadership and the way I interacted with others. I had to stop seeking affirmation, and I had to stop trying to be everybody's buddy. One of the people who helped me improve in this area was my mentor Fred Smith, the consultant, not the founder of FedEx. Once while we were discussing how to handle difficult situations with people, he said, "Always separate what's best for you from what's best for the organization." That statement felt like a smack in the face because too often I had put myself first. I had always thought about what was best for me. Fred gave me a new perspective and suggested that I think about things in a different order. Here's the order he gave me. First, what's best for the organization. Second, what's best for the other people within the organization. And then finally, 3, what's best for me? By learning to ask myself these 3 questions in this order, I was able to clarify my motives for leadership decisions. I must say that during this relational leader shift from pleasing people to challenging people, I felt great loneliness as a leader. The affirmation that had been such a wonderful sound in my ears went silent along with the season. The people who used to seek me out for consensus avoided me when they were unhappy. Some of the people who used to toast me now wanted to roast me. But as I stepped back from the crowd, I started to find myself. And I discovered that if I needed people, I probably couldn't lead them well. That gave me determination to shift from making them happy to helping them get better. Eventually, I began to desire what was best for the people I led more than what made me feel good about myself. As the pull for approval lessened, I felt released to do the right thing as a leader. I shared the vision, raised the bar, challenged others, showed the way, asked for commitment, and stopped waiting for consensus. The organization was able to take ground, and I was able to help people start reaching their God-given potential. Those who didn't want to go with me, I allowed to go their own way, without expending all my energy trying to win them back. It took time, but I learned to love the new leader that I was becoming. No longer did I wait and worry about having everyone on board. The days of allowing unhappy people to manipulate me and steal my joy were over. The first question I asked would no longer be, "Are we all okay?" Instead, I began to consistently ask, "Are we all committed?" One of the greatest lessons I learned in this season was that you never know if people are really with you until you ask them for commitment. When you ask others for commitment, you lose the uncommitted people and you gain the committed ones. When you don't ask for commitment, you keep the uncommitted ones and, regretfully, you lose the committed. You choose who you lose. I also learned that respect is more often earned on difficult ground. People respect leaders who make the hard decisions, who lead by example in tough times instead of just giving orders, who put others first, and who value people enough to ask them to rise up to the greatness that is within them. It's been 45 years since I made that leadership, but I still feel how it has changed me and my leadership. If your leadership is motivated by pleasing others or receiving approval, you need to change your expectations. Shift your focus from what you gain to how you help people, improve your organization, and achieve your vision. Otherwise, your leadership will always be limited. Number two, value people as much as you value yourself. Valuing people is a high priority in my life. Every day I intentionally add value to others. For me, this always starts with valuing myself. We see others as we see ourselves. And if we value ourselves, we are able to value others. Your value assessment of yourself determines your personal investment in others. If you feel that you are worthy of opportunity, you will give others opportunities. If you feel that you are worthy of being developed, you will be willing to develop others. If you see yourself as a 9 out of a 10, you'll be more likely to value others highly. If you devalue yourself, you will probably devalue others. And that's critical because you can't devalue others and be a good leader. Look at how this works. Leaders who value their people give them their best effort. Leaders who devalue their people give them very little effort. Leaders who value their people serve them, and leaders who devalue their people want to be served by them. Leaders who value their people empower them, and leaders who devalue their people control them. Leaders who value their people motivate them. Leaders who devalue their people manipulate them. To get the best out of people, you need to believe the best about people. Only then will you give them your best and ask them to give you their best. Number three, work to establish expectations up front. In my people-pleasing years, I never established expectations up front. I'd tell myself that sometime, somewhere, somehow, I'd broach the topic of expectations when the time was right. But the time was never right, and I never initiated those conversations. Instead, I would work hard to win people over relationally, hoping that they would guess what I wanted from them and that when the tough times came, they would hang with me. But assumptions are never a good method of operation in a leadership world. They always lead to unfulfilled expectations and disappointment. As a leader, you can either set expectations on the front end and set up the working relationships for success, or leave expectations unstated and deal with the disappointment on the back end for both you and the people that you're leading. Today, I see the sharing and setting of expectations on the front end as the litmus test for a leader. I go out of my way to be upfront with people. Upfront appreciation places value on the person and increases the value of our time together. Upfront expectations increase the value of any meeting. The sooner I set expectations, the quicker and easier the meeting. Upfront questions are the quickest way for people to understand one another and increase the value of our time together. Upfront discussion influences the way and the direction we lead others. Upfront decisions increase the value of our time together. You see, being upfront means that you're out in front. When I'm preparing to have an upfront conversation with someone, I work to level set the interaction with one question and 7 statements. First, the question. What are your expectations of our interaction? When I have a conversation with someone, I always invite the other person to go first. It's not only polite, it's smart. Asking a good question without a slanted preamble is good because you can find out what the other person is really thinking, and that's more important than what I want them to think. In addition, if I listen first, the odds increase for the other person to listen to me because he or she has already been heard. When I start a professional relationship with someone, the most important thing to establish up front is our expectations for each other. What does the other person expect of me? What do I expect of him or her? That way, we can find out if our desires are compatible. We may need to adjust our expectations to bring them into alignment so that we can both sign off on them. And if I'm the leader in this relationship, the better I know the person, the better I know how to lead them. Once I have learned the other person's expectations up front by asking questions, I set up expectations for the other person by communicating these statements. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about the big picture. A mature person has the ability to see and respect different perspectives. However, when you're leading a team, department, or organization, you must always keep your eye on the big picture. And maybe you're aware of what I call the law of the big picture in my book, The 17 Indisputable Laws of Teamwork. The law of the big picture simply states the goal is more important than the role. Each person has a role on a team. Why? To help the team accomplish its goal. To fulfill the bigger picture, no individuals, not any team member, not the leader, can lose sight of the goal and get consumed by themselves. This statement has power only when I start with the part that says, it's not about me. I may be the owner of my companies, but I need to remember that it really isn't about me. I don't need to make every leadership decision. I don't need to have my idea win in every meeting. The organization needs to be successful. And if others know that it's not about me, then they should be willing to accept that it's not about them either. This can be difficult for some people, especially if they're very talented and have star potential. But high talent with low self-awareness requires a lot of maintenance. That's why it's important to get expectations settled up front. The team doesn't play its best when its best player thinks it's all about them. You must value other people. All leaders are in the people business. If we want to work well with people, we need to value them and add value to them. And here's the good news. Adding value to people is also good for business. Anyone who works with me needs to value people. That's the core of who I am, and it's the core of all of my companies. We must be willing to serve others, and servant leadership isn't difficult if we value people. When we value people, they feel valued, and we are able to succeed in our mission. You are expected to keep growing. How do you grow an organization? Through the growth of its individual members. The future of any organization can be found in the growth of the people who are a part of it, and especially the people who lead it. As the law of the lid says, leadership ability determines a person's level of effectiveness. I am a lifelong learner who is intentional about learning something every day of my life. I'm also attracted to people who grow. My best friends are the ones who are continually developing themselves. Our conversations are stimulated by our growth journey. I expect everyone who joins my team to be intentional about personal and professional growth. Growing together is even better than growing alone. Teams either grow together or they grow apart. Making a commitment to grow every day and then developing relationships with growing people will keep us on the growth track. You must be prepared to change. There is a vast difference between conceding that change is inevitable and believing that change is essential. The person who concedes that change is inevitable becomes resigned to it and is reactive, thinking, change is going to happen, so what can I do? The individual who believes change is essential is proactive and thinks, I will make change happen so that our team can improve. If growth is expected, then change is essential. We cannot grow without changing. The very fact that I do something better today means that I learned and improved something yesterday. Everyone has